This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined by Adam Ralph, a distributed system enthusiast and digital nomad. He works for Particular Software, the makers of N-Service Bus, and he's joining me from Flims in the Swiss Alps. Thank you very much for taking time out of your Sunday, Adam.
Hey, Brian. It's good to be here.
So to start off, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. Well, as you said, I work on N-Service Bus, and that's an open source project. I love to work on open source. I love to speak. You'll catch me at quite a few conferences around Europe, and I love fixing white space rule violations as well. That's probably my favorite bit about coding.
What's a white space rule violation?
Oh, well, you know, have you ever heard of StyleCop?
No.
It's a C# style thing.
Oh,
that
style
kind
cop.
Of tells
sorry.
You
yes,
when,
yes, yes. Sorry.
Right. So a lot of people call me human style cop.
Okay, and you enforce this on other people in a friendly way or a less than friendly way?
Well, I let the tool do that for me, but yeah, I like to set the rules. I spoke about this recently at a thing called PubConf. I did a talk about fixing white space rules and being a white space bigot, and that's a little passion of mine.
And PubConf is a thing by Todd Garner, kind of a spin-off as part of the NDC conferences?
That's correct. It usually takes place, I think, on the evening of the last day of the conference. And it's a really funny get-together. You have about 10 people speaking, and they all have automatic advancing slides. Every 15 seconds, the slides advance, so they've got to get the timing just right. But it's a lot of fun, and it's kind of a chance to kind of say a lot of things you wouldn't normally be allowed to say in some of the conferences. Kind of what happens at PubConf stays at PubConf is one of the rules.
All right. So aside from the PubConf and the white space particularness, what else do you do, Adam?
Well, I like to drink tea. I'm an Englishman, so since I moved over to the Swiss Alps, I brought that little tradition with me. And I snowboard a lot, so I'm usually either snowboarding or coding. Those are the two kinds of things I do. And you mentioned at the beginning I'm a digital nomad, so I spent most of last year traveling around Europe and writing code. So that's the thing that I've got into now. I've got a camper van, and I've taken my remote working job on the road, as it were.
And remote working is for Particular.
That's correct. Yeah, we're actually a remote working company, 100%. We don't have an office. Even the CEO doesn't have an office. We all work from home, and we're spread out all over the world.
How many? Do you know roughly how many people there are?
I think we're just over 40 now. I think it's about 43. Yeah. So, but I think most of us are in Europe, in the kind of European time zones. Then we've got people in the States. Over in Australia, we've got one guy down in Panama, so we're quite spread out.
Do you guys ever come together to meet as a team?
We do, yeah. In fact, a month ago we had our annual company conference, which is a week where we all get together, and we tend to pick a different city every year. So this time it was Athens, so we're down in Athens for a week, and that's a really great chance to get some face time.
But is that it, once a year to meet your colleagues, or are there other colleagues maybe in Swiss or Northern Italy or Germany that you could just visit occasionally?
That's the one where we all get together, mm-hmm. where the whole company gets together. That's just an annual one. But we do have several smaller things throughout the year. So yeah, there's a couple of other guys who live in Switzerland as well. So I see them fairly often, and there's people in Italy and in the Netherlands and Belgium. So we have kind of small localized little things where we get together as well.
And do you spend all of your time, most of your time on N-Service Bus?
Well, Particular Software is one of those places where there is no typical day. So when people say to me, what do you do? It's a really difficult question to answer because there's so much variety. So I do spend some time working on the service bus, but we do a lot of events. So we like to go out and do workshops and talks and things like that. So I spend a lot of my time on things like that as well.
So you're as much an evangelist as an engineer?
I do try to be, yes. That's part of our mission of our company mission is kind of to make developers better at building complex systems. And there's a number of ways in which we can do that. So, providing frameworks and software is one way, going out and speaking to people and showing them things in workshops is another way. So there's a lot of different kind of activities that we do.
So what is nService Bus? Because that's what we're going to spend most of our time talking about. But let's get maybe a brief overview of it first.
Right. So one of the things we notice when people are trying to build distributed systems, when they're basically trying to get one computer to talk to another, is on the face of it, it sounds relatively simple, but it's when you get into the details that things become difficult. So, what if a certain communication fails between one computer and another computer? What do you do then? What's your retry policy? How do you ensure that messages are not lost? That kind of thing. This is where you kind of need some kind of slightly higher level abstraction as to, or slightly higher level abstraction compared to kind of lower level communication systems like queues. So nService Bus gives you that. It gives you this kind of, this level of infrastructure where if you didn't use something like nService Bus, you'd probably spend most of your time writing that. But as a developer of a line of business application, you want to be spending your time, or at least the company wants you to be spending your time, writing business logic. You want to be capturing the things that your business users have in their minds in code. That's where you can add the most value. So if you can take a level of infrastructure away from that and that, have that done for you, that's a really good thing. And that's essentially what nService Bus does for you.
So you mentioned a queue there, but where does a queue come into it? If I've got service A calling service B, I can just, get the host name, the port and the endpoint and call it. Why do I need a queue at all?
Right. Well, one thing to think about there is what if that other service is down?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it's down and the other service is directly calling it and saying, hey, do this and tell me when you're done. If that service is down, that simply cannot happen. So what a queue allows you to do, it allows you to bring some level of asynchronous operation into that. And I don't mean asynchronous as an async await. That's a slightly different thing. But an actual asynchronous invocation of things. So I can say, well, we want this to happen. So we want, say, an order to be placed. And even if that other system's down, I still want that order to be placed. So instead of communicating with that system via, say, an HTTP call, where if that thing's down, I just can't do it, I put that message into a queue, and that other system can take that message off that queue when it's ready to.
So, all right, I've got a queue. All right, where does a bus come into it now?
Right, so a bus is kind of like it's a kind of higher level abstraction above a queue. So a queue is what queues are really good at is making sure that messages are not lost. So if you put a message in a queue, you've got a high level of guarantee that you'll be able to pull that message off that queue. Now, the problem then is, what if I pull the message off the queue and the database that I need to store that order is down? What I really need to do is to maybe retry, right? Maybe it's a temporary thing. Maybe there's some glitch in the network. Maybe that I just can't talk to that database right now, or maybe it's in the process of being recycled, something like that. What I need to do then is try to talk to the database, and if I fail, well, maybe wait a couple of seconds and try again. And if that doesn't happen, and if I've done that a few times, then I might say, well, let's give it another 5 minutes and let's try again. If it still doesn't work, say, okay, let's give it a bit longer. Let's give it like 15 minutes. This is something known as exponential backoff. Now, if you were using a raw queue, you'd have to write that logic yourself. You'd have to say, well, get the message off the queue, try, wait a bit, try again, maybe put it back in the queue to be delivered later, try again. Maybe it should go to another endpoint. Maybe you've got that logical process scaled out into two processes on two different machines. Maybe the other machine can talk to the database. So then you'd want to put the message back into the queue, give that machine a chance to pull that message down and for it to try to talk to the database. This is all infrastructure you'd have to write yourself if you're using a queue. what Sumdarkand Service Bus does is it provides that for you. It saves you having to worry about that level of kind of nitty-gritty infrastructure. And you, so you can concentrate on writing the business code and let the bus handle the retries.
So again, so you can focus on your business, your own business, as opposed to the business of queuing, retrying and such things.
Exactly. Yeah. And when things don't work out, you might want to put things into like an error queue and say, look, we've given up. We've done this. We've tried to do this so many times. It's not going to work. Put it into an error queue. And then you want a way of pulling stuff back off the error queue once you've maybe identified a bug and replay the message back in through the system after you fix the bug. And again, that's stuff that you'd have to think about yourself if you weren't using a framework and service bus.
When did N-Service Bus, when was it first built, or how did the whole project start?
So our CEO, Udi Dhan, back in the kind of middle part of the last decade, he was working as an independent consultant, and he was going into a lot of firms and kind of trying to show them better ways of building systems and show them the kind of things they have to do in order to get a level of reliability and these kind of retries and other various things in their systems. And he noticed that wasn't really enough. So whilst he could tell people what they should be doing, it still wasn't having enough effect in his mission to try and make things better. So what he tried to do was to build an opinionated framework which captured some of that. So it's not just him coming in and saying, you really ought to like retry messages in this way. Well, here's a framework that can actually do that for you. So it was kind of like a capturing a lot of things he was talking about in code. And I think he started N-Service Bus in around 2007. I think it was that kind of time frame. And a few years later, he decided to make that commercial. So we now actually have a kind of dual license thing where we can give you a free license if you want to use it for open source or personal use, and if you wanted to use it commercially, you have to pay a kind of license fee to us. And that license fee allows us to spend a lot of time now improving that thing, working on documentation, giving a lot of advice for POCs, and that kind of thing. And that's where the business grew from.
If you were to, let's say, pick the main features of N-Service Bus, I know we've mentioned retries. What would you list to say the top five things that would be of benefit to someone who isn't using something like this?
Well, I think one of the things that you can benefit from a lot is the... is not having to worry about each queuing system too much. So if you're using N-Service Bus and you're actually using MSMQ behind the scenes, or you're using RabbitMQ behind the scenes, or you're using Azure Service Bus behind the scenes, the code that you write remains largely the same. Now, we all work on different systems and we all change jobs. Now, if you had to kind of reinvent the wheel of trying to re-implement things like retries or other things for each queuing system, you would spend a lot of time doing that. But with N-Service Bus, changing from one transport to the other, whether it's for an existing system or whether it's when you change onto another system or change to another department or change to another company, the code that you write remains largely the same. It's more or less just a case of some config in your kind of entry point to your program, and the rest, the actual code that you write for your business logic, looks almost exactly the same. So that's one really good thing. We've already talked a lot about retries. Things like deduplication. So the problem with talking from one system to another system is a lot of people make too many assumptions about the network. So things like the network is reliable. Things like, well, a queuing system should only deliver a message once. Bandwidth is infinite, that kind of thing. These are what are known as the fallacies of network computing. And one of the things you might find when you actually start using a queuing system is because the network's not reliable, you might get a message delivered twice. You might end up sending a message twice. And most queuing systems have the notion of at least once delivery. So that means you will get that message once. You may, in some circumstances, get it more than once. So N Service Bus has a thing called the outbox, which helps with deduplication. So that's another really good thing that helps. And N Service Bus is only one part of what we call the particular platform, the particular software platform. So N Service Bus is the thing that goes kind of built, that gets built into your software that you're running, that you're writing, to allow you to spend all your time on business logic. But we have this thing called the particular software platform, which ingests, say, audit messages. And so every time a message flows through your system, an audit message is generated as well. That goes into something called service control, which collates all those audit messages. You can then view them in something called service insight. And service insight will draw a diagram of what's talked to what and what message invoked another message. And that's something that's really, really useful that you would have to build entirely yourself. And off the back of that, we've got another thing called Service Pulse. And Service Pulse is a monitoring solution. So that tells you when, say, you've got lots of messages in your error queue, or it tells you when your endpoints are down and that kind of thing. So there's a kind of wider benefit outside just N Service Bus itself, because you can plug the whole platform into it.
Then you have things like pub sub and the like. It's easy to do pub sub.
Right, so some transports or some queuing systems like MSMQ, for instance, do not have the notion of pub sub built into them. So they don't have this notion of publish the message and many subscribers receive that message. So you kind of have to actually write that yourself for MSMQ. You have to send a message to something that's sending messages and say, hey, when you send this kind of message, I'm interested. That system would have to store that subscription somewhere. And when it wants to publish that message, it would have to look through its list of subscribers and send that message to all the subscribers. That's all stuff that you'd have to write yourself if you're using MSMQ. And that's what N Service Bus provides for you over MSMQ. It's one of the things it provides.
And then there's a thing called sagas. Can you explain those?
Right. So sagas capture something that is known as a long-running business process. So how does that differ to a normal process? Well, a standard kind of process that's not long-running is kind of you get some inputs, you do some work, and you have an output. The difference with a long-running process is that entire process is invoked by a series of messages. So it's like get a message in, do some work, wait for the next message. Get another message, do another bit of work, wait for the next message, and so on, until finally you might get a message which says, or after which that message you can say, okay, my work is done and the process is finished. And it's not long running as in, you know, I look at my watch and say, you know, this is taking a long time. It's long running because the amount of time taken to run that process is non-deterministic, because you don't know when you're going to get the next message. So in terms of time, the pure metric of time, it may end up being long running, like days, or it may just be, you know, a matter of a second or less than a second if those messages come in quick succession. But it's a non-deterministic amount of time that it runs for that makes it long running. And sagas encapsulate that. So a saga in a service bus, what it gives you is a pre-built mechanism to receive a message and store state, receive another message, restore state, receive another message, store state, mark as complete.
So when you're talking about storing state, what do you mean?
So the thing that really makes a long-running process different to a standard process is this state. Because when you get one message in, you need to record some kind of outcome of what happened from that first message, so that when you receive a second message, you can act on the data that you, on the knowledge that you gained from the first message. Because if you didn't do that, you'd have a standard process. because if you got a message in and did something and forgot about things, there's no correlation with that second message. So that's what makes a long running process different. You get a message in, you do some work, you make some business decisions, you store the result of that business decision, right? That's the persistence of state. Then you get another message in, you act based on what that message contains and the decision you made after the first message. That's your retrieval of the state. So you can see between each invocation, between each message that's received, you need to store some kind of state to record where you are in the business process.
So to kind of make it concrete for people, because sagas are really, really powerful. I remember seeing an example with something like a financial institution receiving international transfers. Can you explain that example?
Okay, so let's say if you're a bank and you received a request to send some money to another bank. Now, it doesn't work as simply as you don't open a transaction across the two banks, for instance. So you don't say, oh, well, deduct the money from the account in this bank and add the money to the account in that bank. And then, right, were you all ready to go? Okay, commit transaction. You don't do that, right? One bank could be in New York, one bank could be in Sydney. You don't open like a technical level transaction across two banks. What you do is you send the money across the wire into a thing called SWIFT. SWIFT is like a system for doing this.
And this is an international banking thing, nothing to do with particular or end service bus.
Exactly. That's an external international banking transfer system. So what you do is on your side, you say, okay, I'm going to send this money to this other bank across SWIFT. Now, at that point, you might open a saga. You might start a saga to say, well, I've sent the money to this bank. Then what you want to do is, and this might take a couple of days, right? So for a couple of days, this money is kind of like in the ether before the other bank receives it. The SWIFT system will try and tell the other bank, hey, accept this money from this bank over here. That bank at some point will say, yes, we can accept it. Or they might say, no, the account's closed. Now, if it's less interesting when everything goes well. It's more interesting when things go wrong. So let's say that account in Sydney was closed in the meantime. SWIFT will not be able to transfer the money in to that bank. So the bank says, no, we can't accept it. SWIFT will then say, hey, we couldn't actually accept this. That can come in as a message into a saga, and that saga can say, well, okay, what do we need to do now? We need to take some kind of compensating action. The interesting thing is that sometimes you might not get all the money back. There might be some kind of charge involved in a failed transaction. So it's not just a case of simply reversing that transaction in the user's in the customer's account. It might be a case of putting in a reversing action with not necessarily the same amount of money, with a slight deduction to it. And this is the kind of state that a saga can manage for you. On the other hand, if everything goes well, the saga get the message back from SWIFT that the transaction completed, and then they can mark the saga as complete. So that's a simple example of the basic mechanics.
So it sounds like you can substitute what would be nice to do as an ongoing process that would be just running until it finishes, but obviously you can't in this case because it could be taking place over days across multiple restarts of a server. So you can reload the state, continue from where you were, perform the next piece of logic, go to sleep, wait for something to happen, perform the next piece of logic.
Right. So what's interesting about that is we call it a long-running business process, right? Long-running. Mm-hmm. But between the message invocations, what's that process actually doing? It's actually doing nothing. All it is some state sitting in the database. So when you start to think about it that way, you can start to think of the notion of an infinitely long-running process. So a good example is, let's say you're running a mobile game, right? A mobile app game. And you want to record your users' activities in order to give them bonuses or to level them up and give them extra features and things like that. So you record in a saga when a user starts playing the game, You record things like when they buy things. You record how often they play it and things like that. And each time you get a message in telling you this, you store it in the state of the saga. Now, when is that saga actually complete? It's never, right? I mean, I know there are things coming in like, you know, the European GRDP and stuff like that. So you might, they're kind of like right to forget things coming along. But ignoring that, you don't ever really want to forget about that user state, because they might stop playing for the game for a year, might come back a year later, and you want to be familiar with that user. You want to know how much they played the game before. You want to be able to give them new stuff and, hey, you know, welcome back, that kind of thing. So that is an example of a potentially infinitely long-running saga. The other way to look at that is, effectively, that is replacing something that you might call an entity in a typical system. You might design a user entity in a system. But if you're using a saga to react to messages in that way, that's effectively performing that role for you. So we call it long-running business process. Well, actually, that could be like infinite state that you want to keep for your business.
So one of the, just to change slightly, one of the big things we hear about when we're talking about services, and I know we didn't specifically mention microservices, but I imagine end service bus is used with SOA, with microservices and like, is the concept of loose coupling. So how would end service bus help us if we wanted to decouple or loosely couple systems?
Well, what we try and do with end service bus is we try and lead people down the right path. So we try and lead people down through what we call the pit of success. Now, what that means is we try and make it so that, well, if you follow our opinions and if you follow the way that we think you should be writing things, you can't help but be successful, right? That is the general idea. Now, when it comes to things like coupling, you've got different types of coupling. So you mentioned at the beginning about calling another service directly, and the thing that people usually reach for is HTTP. All right, there's some service over here which I need to do something, or has some data which I need. I'm going to call it via HTTP to do that work. That's called temporal coupling, because you're coupled to that other service in the temporal plane. If that service is not there at the time that you call it, you're stuck. That's temporal coupling. All right, and there's another kind of coupling which is location based. So if you have services running on many different machines, and you need to know what those machines are or where those machines are and their host names and things like that, that's location based coupling. Right, things like a broker can help with that. Obviously DNS can be used to some degree with that. But things like a brokered queuing system can help with that, because you need to kind of know the location of one machine, and then subscriptions and things take care of the rest. Then you've got things like coupling at the logical level. So if, for instance, one service needs to know a lot about another service, so if it needs to send a message to another service with lots and lots of details. Good example is something like, I'm on Amazon and I place an order, and that goes to some kind of order service. That order service has to send all the payment details, like credit card details, expiry date, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff, to a finance service to do the processing of the actual payment. That's a high degree of coupling between the order service and the finance service. If I want to introduce a new way to pay for things, let's say Bitcoin, right? I want to accept Bitcoin as a payment for books. I can't really make that change in isolation in the finance service, because all of a sudden the order service has to know about how it can tell the finance service about a Bitcoin payment. So that's a high degree of coupling. And the problem with that is, if you want to make a change like that, all of a sudden you've got much, much more places to change and possibly more teams to align with changes and releases and things like that. So this is something we try and steer people away from with the approaches that we recommend within Service Bus.
So what is the alternative to what you just described in that last example?
So what we want to be doing is you want to be trying to slim down your messages. So in that example I gave, so let's say you're buying some books on Amazon. Now, what you typically do is you go through a workflow. So when you go check out, when you've got things in your basket, first of all, you choose your shipping address. Then you might choose your payment details. And then at the end, you might review the order and you might say place order. Now, when you choose your shipping address, you can create an order ID at that point, at that time. And this goes against the intuitive approach that is used by a lot of developers, in that, well, we should only create the order ID when we have all the order details. So you can even generate a order ID in the front end, right? There are libraries in JavaScript for generating GUIDs or UUIDs, if you're not talking about the Microsoft variant. When you choose your shipping method, you can send a message to the shipping service to say, here are the shipping details for order and then GUID. Then when you choose your payment details, you can send a message to the finance service saying, here are the payment details for order and then the GUID. Then when you place the order at the end, that's when you send a message to the, let's say, order service for that same order ID. If that order service accepts the order, you know, it might want to check inventory or, you know, whatever it wants to do, it then raises an event. And that event says, order accepted. Now, all it has to do at that point is provide the order ID, because the shipping service already has the order with the shipping details. The finance service already has the shipping the order ID with the payment details. And all they have to do is react to a certain event, to an event called order placed, and with one property on it, order ID. And this is what is called slimming down your events. This is thin events versus fat events. In that way, imagine if you want to add a Bitcoin payment. All you have to do is send a new message to the finance service to say, here are the Bitcoin payment details. The order service doesn't have to change at all. The shipping service doesn't have to change at all, because the order service keeps raising its single order placed event with an order ID. And the finance service reacts to that, charges Bitcoin.
Because I know you see discussions online about what's called, I think, is it called contract coupling? So what you're describing here is making that contract as small as possible, so it's unlikely that you really are coupled. That's what it sounds like to me.
It is that. I mean, if you can get your system to a state where you're just passing IDs around, then that's a very low level of that contract coupling, as you call it. So it allows far more autonomy within the services. And the trick to doing that often is that creating the ID up front, rather than at the end, which you see in a lot of systems, you create that ID right at the beginning. You could even create an order ID when you search, right? Searching for a catalog of products. Why not create an order ID then? Send that, you know, store that, and that with that you can get really rich analytics, right? Because a lot of people say, oh, well, won't we end up with a lot of redundant data then? What if someone doesn't place the order?
That's good. You still know what they search for.
Exactly. You can go. You can get a lot of rich business analytics from that. And at the end, you know, what is that redundant data? It's just a couple of rows in some database somewhere in that service and that service and that service. It's pretty cheap, right? Data storage is pretty cheap price to pay for the possibility of getting those really rich rich analytics.
So to come back to nService Bus, you know, this sounds like a big system, complicated, and I know you're going to tell me it's not, but before we do that, what scale do I need to be at before I would need to start using, you know, okay, at some point I'll need to use queues. Great. I can maybe handle them by myself. Where would you say, at what scale should I be before I start using nService Bus?
I would say that Well, first of all, as you said, it sounds big and complicated, and it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It can be as complicated as you like. You know, that's a kind of slider that you control. You should start thinking about using some kind of service bus when you want to introduce a certain level of reliability to your business processing. So, for instance, if you're running something like a web shop, if it's okay for you to miss orders when your system is down, then don't use a service bus. If you want to make sure that you can always accept orders 24 hours a day, regardless of whether you can actually process them at that time, then you need to start thinking about doing something asynchronously. So one of the first rules of business is always take the money, right? Take the money as early as possible. Sort the problems out later. If you don't take the money, you can't even give yourself the option to sort out those problems later for the customer. Because ultimately, if I order something which is going to arrive on my doorstep a few days later, it doesn't matter if I process that order in right now as I click the button, or I process it later on that night. So a level of asynchronicity will give you that. So a way of achieving that is to have a really thin web layer, right? You have a very thin website or web API, and all that does is take in requests, puts a message on a queue. Take requests, put message on the queue, right? That's a very easy thing to keep working. It doesn't rely on any databases. All it relies on is some kind of queuing system to be there, right? And queuing systems are very good at being reliable. Then you can think about processing those things asynchronously. And that's where something like a service bus will really help you.
If someone's just listening to this podcast right now and they're saying, yeah, this is brilliant, I love it, or I just want to play with it, it still sounds like there's a lot of infrastructure. So if you've got Visual Studio and you just want to start using a service bus, what do you need? Where do you go?
So that's one of the things we've been working on a lot recently. We're trying to show people just how easy this is. So we've actually got a thing now called the learning transport. So the transport is a concept in a service bus which encapsulates the queuing system you're using. So we have a RabbitMQ transport, we have an MSMQ transport, we have an Azure Service Bus transport. In the end service bus package itself, there's a learning transport, which is just uses a file system. So you don't need Rabbit, you don't need Azure Service Bus, you don't need MSMQ to start off and start playing with this. Similarly, we've got a learning persistence which saves stuff to disk. So if you're using sagas, it will just save that stuff to disk, as opposed to having to use SQL Server or some other database platform. So, you know, the kind of quick start of Service Bus is fire up Visual Studio, create a console app, for instance, install Service Bus, send a message, and receive it in a handler, which inherits from a base class, and hit F5. And that really is kind of the out-of-the-box experience that we're going for. That will use a learning transport and learning persistence and things like that by default. Once you're ready, once you've got a level of confidence, then you can think, well, okay, using the file system locally is not enough. Let's actually introduce a proper queue, persisting in these plain files on disk is not enough. Let's introduce SQL Server. But you do that when you choose to, when you're ready to.
When you say persistent SQL Server, we've been talking about MSMQ, RabbitMQ. What do you mean by persistent SQL Server?
So if you're using MSMQ, the thing that I described earlier where you need to tell another endpoint that you're subscribed to their messages, that other endpoint has to store that subscription somewhere, right? It has to say, all right, I've got to remember that machine over there wants this message when I publish it. So it records that fact in SQL Server. And that is what is known as a persistence in N Service Bus. So we have different persistence packages. So you can plug in SQL Server, you can plug in Postgres, Oracle. There are community packages for other things, so not managed by us, but the communities produce for like MongoDB and things like that. So that is persistence. And then you also use it for sagas. So that saga state that I talked about earlier, you don't have to worry about persisting that, and Service Bus does it for you. But you need to tell N Service Bus where to persist it. You say, well, okay, when you're going to persist that, do it in SQL Server, do it in Oracle.
So if I get started with, you know, the local file system, and then I move on to the queues or the databases, and I start building up a bigger and bigger system, how do I keep an eye on what's happening? Because it sounds like there's going to be messages, there's going to be metrics, there's going to be, you know, stuff that I need to know about.
Right, that's a really good question, and that's something we've been concentrating a lot in the past year, particular. We've actually just released a much more advanced monitoring solution. So we've always had this thing called Service Pulse, which ingests heartbeats from different endpoints. It can tell you when things are up and down, and it can tell you if things are going to the error queue and things like that. What you can do now as well is a level of real-time monitoring. And this is really good because it gives you things like processing time, so how long different endpoints are taking to process messages, the number of messages that are being pulled from the queue, the number of messages successfully processed, the number of failures, and you get these nice real-time graphs ticking along. So if you see something, you know, kind of going upwards in terms of processing time, you might think, oh, well, you know, that endpoint looks like it's having trouble. Maybe I ought to scale it out or add some more instances or something like that. And you can look at them at a logical level. So if I've got one endpoint scaled out in 10 over 10 machines, it can tell you how that generally is doing. Or you can drill into individual instances. So on that particular machine, how are things going? This is something we've invested a lot of time into recently.
And just as you mentioned scale, and because everyone's talking about containers, I assume N Service Bus and containers will be absolutely fine together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, when people talk about containers, they start to talk about Linux a lot.
Sure.
So we've actually released an RC of N Service Bus 7, which introduces .NET Core support.
Okay.
And the RC, we do like to do proper RC. So, you know, if there are no bugs found, that will be the RTM, and it comes with a go live license, which means we will support it in production. So that's one of the really exciting things happening right now. Then Service Bus is this .NET Core support.
When do you think RTM is coming?
RTM is, I would say, imminent. In quotes, you know, we're just trying to get as many customers as we can to switch to the RC, just to iron out any big bugs before making like a big kind of announcement. But we are confident that the RC is good, and the go live license we give out with the RC is our kind of statement of that. That, you know, we think this is good enough, and you've got problems, we will support you. So I think it's soon.
Any final notes before we wrap up, Adam?
Well, I think a lot of the stuff we've covered today is a lot of the stuff that I talk about in the SOA Done Right workshop, which I've been running recently, which you attended in London.
In London. And that was at the Norwegian Developer Conference, London.
That's correct, and I'm going to be running that again in Copenhagen in May at a conference called MicroCPH, and we'll be delivering that workshop again in NDC Oslo. So if anyone wants to kind of dive deeper into these topics, that's a really good workshop to attend. And then if you want to go even deeper into those topics, Udi Dahan, our CEO, he runs a 5-day advanced distributed system design course, so he really gets into the nuts and bolts of this stuff there. So these are good things to consider if you want to get more into this kind of thing.
Brilliant. Well, Adam Ralph, thank you very much for taking time out of your Sunday.
Thank you very much, Brian. I've enjoyed it.
The opening music was a return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Clay Pawn Shop by the Blue Dot Sessions from the album Castro.